Find our way into Godsock's treasure chest soon, I think. It looks as if London may have visitors before long.
You mean the movement? Asked Fever, taking her place at the table.
Are the nomads coming here? Asked Fern, looking half excited and half scared. Is there going to be fighting?
No, 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 nothing like that, Kit Solent said hurriedly. The movement's hoys and wagons have been sighted north of the moatway, that's all. Even Gilpin Ween has finally admitted that it's time to do something. The trained bands are mustering.
The movement have a traction castle, announced Ruin. They have armies of stalkers, too. They're hairy savages, and they think only of fighting and conquering.
That's not really true, Roo, his father said patiently. Northerners aren't so bad. In many ways, they're more civilized than a lot of people in London. But if they do plan to capture the city, I'd like to have the contents of Godsork's vault in my possession by the time they arrive. They'd pay me well for it.
How do you know? Asked Fever.
Why do you think they're coming here? They've never shown any interest in this place before.
You think they've learned of the vault somehow? But you said no one knew of it.
I said no other human being knew of it, Kit corrected her. There were always stories that a few Skriven had escaped and sought refuge with the nomads in the north. And what if one of them knew something about Godsork and his secrets?
If you feel up to it, I'd like to take you back through the tunnel.
But I can't open the door, Master Solent.
Fever couldn't understand why he had such faith in her.
I can't just pull the right combination of numbers out of thin air.
Kit reached out and touched her, gripping her shoulder with a firm, fatherly hand.
Not out of thin air, Fever. Out of that remarkable brain of yours. You can do it. I'm sure you can.
For the second morning running, Charlie Shallow came awake to the noise of Bagman Creech's helpless, chesty coughing. He lay for a moment wondering where he was, letting the memories of the day before assemble themselves around him in the dark. He was lying in the spare room of Creech's lodgings on Ketch Causeway, on a bed he had made for himself out of old sacks and his bundled-up coat. Brown paper was pasted on the windows to keep the room shady, but that wasn't for Charlie's benefit. It was to protect all the books. The books rose all around him, crammed onto shelves that covered every wall. Not just books, but rolled-up documents and sheaves of yellowed paper done up with hairy string. All of them were about the Skriven. Creech called them his archive. Charlie thought back to the night before. That paper boy folded up and twitching in his hands as he tiptoed up to Solent's house. Later, back at Wormtimber's place, he had watched as the former engineer carefully snipped open the paperboy's finger and took out a little rubber sack. He had let two ruby droplets fall from it onto a glass slide and then carried it to another of his weird old machines. This one he called a electric microscope. It was powered by a treadmill, and since Wormtimber's slaves and servants were all in bed and this was Skinner's business, it was Charlie's job to walk the treadmill while the two old men peered into the machine's viewing window.
"Is that Skriven blood?" Wormtimber had asked.
"I don't know."
Bagman Creech sounded unsure of himself, the same way he had at Summertown when he was staring at the Crumb Girl's face.
"Well, it ain't human, is it?" insisted Wormtimber. "There's something wrong with it. What are all them little whirligig things?"
"I don't know, Master Wormtimber. A disease, perhaps. Maybe the girl's sick, and that's what makes her look not quite right."
"No one's this sick, Master Creech," insisted Wormtimber, baring his sharp little dog teeth. "When I view human blood through this device, or that of any decent animal, I see little red spots, corpuscles and such, not this."
They moved away, still talking, and Charlie stepped off the treadmill. In the second or so, while the microscope still had power, he put his face to the viewing window and gazed deep into the ocean of Fever Crumb's blood. Strange things were swimming there, all right. They left their after-image on his eyes long after the light of the screen had died, little square shapes dithering this way and that, as if surprised to find themselves no longer in Fever's veins, each one propelled by a tiny twirling tail. He kicked his way out from under the sacks, pulled on his coat, and crept down a passage walled with stacked bundles of old newspapers to Bagman's room. That room was book-lined, too. There was also a desk and a lamp, and the old man sitting up in his narrow bed, coughing and coughing, to rid his lungs of the snots and slurries that had puddled in them while he slept. He nodded his good morning to Charlie, wet-eyed, too breathless to talk. Charlie stood and watched him from the doorway. He felt helpless in the face of Bagman's gales of coughing. You didn't grow up in Ditch Street without learning that a cough like that usually ended in a coffin. But he couldn't quite bring himself to frame the awful thought, Master Creech is dying.
"What about some breakfast?" he asked nervously, feeling that he had to do something. "I could do some eggs and stuff."
Bagman nodded and gave him a thumbs up.
Inside his chest, his lungs rustled like two brown paper bags being blown up. Charlie didn't wait for the next fit of coughing, but fled down the stairs to the street door and out onto Ketch Causeway, buttoning his coat as he went. Bagman hadn't given him any money, but he guessed the Skinner's name was good for credit at any shop in the Low City. He crossed Ditch Street and ran round to the market on St. Kylie Hill. The stallholders there knew him, and to his surprise they already knew about his change of luck. "You're with Master Creech now, ain't you, Charlie? Give him my compliments, son. Any luck finding that patch-skin girl yet?" "We're working on it," Charlie promised. He picked out 6 eggs and a slab of butter, and they waved away any talk of payment. Bagman Creech don't need to pay, especially not in troubled times like these. Charlie wasn't certain what that last bit meant. Then, walking home, he started noticing the clumps of people stood gossiping on the street corners. Curious, he followed a gang of prentices into Celebrity Square, which he found to be full of men in the uniforms of the trained bands, thick coats of russet felt with white facings, and black leather helmets. 2 quartermasters stood in the back of a wagon, handing down arquebuses and pouches of powder and shot. A big red fist seized him by his coat collar and spun him around. There stood Ted Swiney, his breath smoking in the chilly morning air. He'd come through from the Mott and Hoople to see the muster, and spotted Charlie Shallow instead.
"Well," he said.
"Well, what, Ted?"
Ted shook him briefly.
"I told you to keep me informed, didn't I? So what have you been playing at?"
"I couldn't get away, Ted, honest." Ted noticed that people were watching and let go of his grip on Charlie's coat. He smoothed the crumpled fabric and grinned as if he'd only been teasing.
"So what's old Bagman turned up? Anything more about that patch-skin girl?"
Charlie was shaking so badly that he dropped one of his eggs. It broke on the cobbles between his feet with a sound like a tiny clap. "Master Creech ain't even sure she is a patch-skin. He's still investigating."
Ted growled, looking past Charlie at the militiamen. A drum had started to rattle, and there was a lot of shouting and confusion as the part-time soldiers tried to form up in battalions. Some heavy horses, commandeered from a dairy in St. Kylie, trotted past pulling a cannon.
"Well, you tell Bagman he'd better hurry up," Ted said. "Our boys are off to guard the moatway in case these movement numpties try breaking through. They don't want to think there's a patch skin on the loose at home, menacing their womenfolk and nippers. They want to see it sorted."
"But if she ain't a scriven, Ted?"
"Who gives a blog? Kill her anyway. You can always paint some speckles on her afterward. It'll cheer people up. Tell you what, once you've offed her, I'll have the skin. Look good on the wall behind the bar, a scriven skin would."
"I don't think Master Creech would like that, Ted."
"Who cares what Master Creech thinks? I'm running this show, Charlie. You bring me the skin. Think what a boost it'll be for our brave lads."
And he sent Charlie on his way with a friendly pat on the head and called out to some passers-by,
"My boy, we're helping Creechy out. Don't worry, we'll soon have that patch skin caught and butchered."
Charlie ran all the way back to Ketch Causeway. He didn't tell Bagman about his meeting with Ted, but he thought he ought to hear about the trained bands mustering. The sound of drum and fife came faintly from the streets outside while he breathlessly explained the news. Bagman Creech just shrugged. He had news of his own.
"I've been thinking, Charlie."
The desk, the bed, and the floor of Bagman's bedroom were covered with open books and spread-out papers. There was a big yellowed map with red crosses marking all the places where Scriven had been found and killed in the years since the riot. Bagman stabbed his finger down onto a little cluster of crosses out in the brick marsh, southeast of the city.
"I checked the records, the notes the old Skinner's made. There's things that don't add up. Scriven we had cornered at the Barbican during the riot, who vanished and turned up weeks later, holed up in Godsork's old gaff out on the marshes. I never caught on at the time, but there must be a passage, a tunnel of some sort, linking Ludgate Hill with his old house. I reckon that's where Solent's doing his real digging. We need to get down there, see what he's found, and how the girl's involved."
Charlie looked down at the bag in his hands, the 5 eggs and the butter.
"What about breakfast, Master Creech?"
"No time, Charlie. A bite of toast, maybe? A mug of tea to set us up? We'll save your eggs for later. For a victory feast."
Chapter 14. Skinners in the Brick Marsh. That day, although the long walk through the tunnels was the same, the chamber and the vault door seemed changed. They felt too familiar to be places that Fever had seen only once. She remembered a cracked flagstone 3 paces from the door, and held her lantern up to look for it, and there it was, although she was sure she had not noticed it the day before,
because it lay in the shadow cast by the toolbox. So how had she known? She was starting to feel scared. She wished Dr. Crumb was there. She missed his calm, careful way of getting to the bottom of mysteries. Without him, she felt panicky and very young. "Are you sure it would not be better to send word to Godsock's head?" she asked meekly. "Perhaps a more experienced engineer..."
"Try the door," said Kit, and held his lantern up to light the lock. Weird feelings of déjà vu flooded through Fever. Memories of yesterday mingled with memories of other yesterdays that could not possibly be her own. Pain was beating again at the base of her skull. She began to wonder if she was still inside her dream. If she climbed the stairs again and went outside, would there be lights in the unbroken windows of Nonsuch House? Would the float lanterns be rising still above the ornamental ponds, pink as blushes, gold as harvest moons? She forced her eyes to turn toward the line of keys set in the doorframe, and suddenly, as if one of those gods in whom engineers did not believe had just whispered it in her ear, she knew the code. They were pushing through the marshes south of Bankmanside, following one of the old causeways through the birch woods and diggers' heaps and the ruins of drowned boroughs. Bagman had commandeered a coracle, a marshman's little wicker and tarcloth boat, and Charlie carried it upended on his shoulders, blundering along behind his master like a black beetle. "Where is this place we're going?" he asked.
"Godsawk's gaff," said Bagman Creech, scanning the drifting mist ahead for hints of trouble. "His summer palace in the marsh."
"I heard of Godsawk. He was king of the Patchskins, weren't he?"
"He was at the end. He didn't want to be. The Scriven elected him king, thinking he'd save them. But they were past saving by then. Godsawk was an inventor, mostly. Forever tinkering and fiddle-arsing with the old technology, the way some Scriven did. They said there was a laboratory under that summer place of his where he did experiments on dead people and stuff, though I never saw it for myself."
"You were there?"
Bagman Creech nodded.
"The place got overlooked in the riots, but a couple of weeks later we got word that some escaped Scriven had holed up there. Me and some of the lads got together and came out here. We followed this very path you're walking now, boy."
Charlie tried to feel suitably awed and told himself that he was walking on history, but mostly it still felt as if he was walking on porridge. The wood of the causeway was rotted and slimy, and the coracle on his back made him clumsy. Several times he almost fell, and at last Bagman called a halt. They left the path and squatted in the angle between two old walls, eating a bath bun and wiping the sugar and crumbs from their mouths on the sleeves of their coats. Bagman lit his pipe, and the smoke went up to mingle with the mist, and his memory went homing back to that day on this same path long ago.
"When we got to Godsawk's gaff, we found they'd cut the causeway, and we had to wade the last bit. A slough of water, shoulder deep, with Godsawk's gardens rising up out of it ahead. Croquet hoops still stuck in the lawns. I was in the lead, halfway across, when all of a sudden these things started jumping up out of the water all around us. Wet and shiny they was, like black snakes, jumping straight up. I didn't know what was happening, till the bloke on my right got hit, and then the bloke on my left. And I realised there were bullets coming down all around us. There were Scriven hiding in Godsawk's gardens, shooting at us with hunting guns."
"What did you do, Master Creech?"
"I ducked, didn't I?"
Bagman fingered a half-moon nick in the brim of his bowler, where a bullet had taken a bite.
"It was all I could do. Went down quick, like I'd been shot. Ducked right under the water so that only me hat was left, floating on the surface. At least, that's how it would have looked to the Scriven. Only what they couldn't see was that I'd got my face poking up inside the hat so as I could breathe. I stayed like that for hours."
"And the other men?"
"All dead, son. There was one just wounded. Billy Kite from Battersea. I could hear him yelling out for help. But the Scriven kept banging their guns at him, and after a while they must have hit him again, because he shut up. And there I stood, up to my nose in marsh mud, hiding in my own hat till sundown. And then I pushed on."
"Didn't you want to go back? Run away?"
"Course I did. I was half frozen and two-thirds drowned. But I had work to do, didn't I? So I pressed on till I reached Godsawk's garden, and I reckon the Scriven weren't expecting me, because they hadn't set much of a guard. I climbed out of the marsh looking like a part of the marsh, and I went creeping through them gardens, and up to that house, and I did what was needful. That's the good thing about a spring gun. There's no powder to get wet, so a soaking won't harm it much."
"You killed them?"
Bagman Creech nodded.
I was pretty sick of killing Scriven by then, mind. It didn't feel like a big victory. It weren't rock and roll the way the riots was. It was just this nasty job I had to do. And when it was done, I lit the place on fire, and the flames went way up high, because it was full of smart furnishings and tapestries and stuff. And the light of all that burning was enough for me to find my way back home to London by.
And was Godsalk there? Asked Charlie. Was he one of the ones you killed?
Nah, he was dead by then. Killed in the Barbican, third day of the riots. Nasher Modbury's crew caught him. You can't kill me, that's what he told them. Stood and laughed at them. He wasn't short of courage. But they killed him, all right. Later, there were stories that he tricked them somehow and escaped, but I saw his speckled hide with my own eyes. He's dead, all right.
They moved on, and soon the need for a coracle became clear. The causeway they were following stopped short, as if it had been bitten off. A stretch of glassy water spread itself before them, filled with clumps of reeds and drifting litter, and the reflection of a strange stepped hill that rose up ahead, with overgrown gardens around its feet and a crown of old walls. Charlie scrambled through the thick mud at the water's edge and set the coracle afloat. As he helped Bagman in, the vessel wobbled, and beads of water swelled along a badly sealed join. But it floated, and Charlie scrambled in as well, and unshipped the paddle that was lashed under the seat. Ahead, the hill was silent. The ruins blanched and faded as the mist blew past them. It was hard to imagine that there was anyone there, let alone Kit Solent and his tame Scriven, or whatever she was. Charlie wondered what would happen if they found nothing. He didn't know if he'd be disappointed or relieved. And she knew the code. She stood there, frozen, her fingers raised in front of the lock's keys, and just as surely as she knew that she was Fever Crumb, she knew that if she pressed the numbers 25193640 85 in sequence, the door would slide up into the roof, and the door behind it would slide to the right, and the door behind that would slide to the left. The counterweights that moved the heavy doors would rattle, and the gears would make a noise like big dogs growling. "Go on," said Kit, softly and kindly, but with something steely hard beneath the kindness, an eagerness she had not heard before. "You know it, Fever, don't you? Open the door." Outlandish visions burst in Fever's brain. Battles and balls and ships at sea, and Dr. Crumb kneeling before her on a tiled floor, and a woman she knew but didn't know, laughing in sunlight, and the pools and lanterns and... "Open it!" shouted Kit Solent. Fever fled. She stumbled sideways, kicking the lantern over so that it went out, but she found her way easily through the darkness, and her hand closed on the familiar ivory handle of the door that led outside. Outside, she thought. Fresh air. She could hear Kit behind her calling out, "Fever!" Up the stairs she went, and out through the door in the hillside, into mist. "Fever!" Kit Solent was calling, down inside the hollow hill. "Fever, come back! It's all right! I didn't mean to shout!" Fever still felt groggy, but she forced herself to move away from the door and climb the hill, going up from terrace to terrace the way she had the day before. She wanted to find somewhere where she could sit quietly alone for a while and think. What was happening to her? Was she ill? Was she going mad? On the top of the hill, the mist moved among old burned timbers, between the fallen walls. Something splashed in the marshes, a bird, Fever guessed. She walked through the roofless, ruined rooms and found she knew them. This one had been carpeted. This one had been tiled. In this corner had stood a fine teak bookcase, glass-fronted, whose silver handles she uncovered with a bit of scrabbling, little dirty blobs of pooled metal buried in grass and clinker underfoot. "I must have been here before," she reasoned. "I must have been here when I was a tiny child." But she knew that she could not have been more than a few months old when Nonesuch House burned. Surely a child that tiny would not know what a bookcase was, let alone remember it. Along the hall she walked, through the arch where the grand front door had been, out onto the gravel drive, gone all to moss and nettles now, where the guests used to leave their sedan chairs. She hummed a dance tune from 20 years before, and it stirred up fresh memories. The ghosts of Scriven dancers moved around her, shadowy, the great dresses of the women rustling and sighing, but they were not real. They were in her head. "It's not the house that's haunted," she thought. "It's me." There, across the lawn, was the dear old summer house, its roof fallen in now, its walls thick grown with ivy. She walked toward it, and remembered walking toward it one warm evening, with music spilling from the house behind her, and ahead of her in the night a soft laugh, a sigh. She stopped short, clutching her head, wincing at the pain that hammered there. When she opened her eyes again, a boat had drawn up at the foot of the hill, and a man and a boy were climbing the overgrown lawns. For a moment, confused, Fever thought they were guests arriving late for the party. She started downhill to greet them, then realized her mistake. She would never have invited such a shabby pair to one of her parties. It was the old man from Summertown and his ragged boy.
"Master Creech!" the boy shouted, looking up and seeing her standing there.
The old man came straight for her, and his pale eyes were shining, fixed upon her face. He stopped 10 feet from her, facing her across one of the ponds.
"What are you?"
he asked again, in a hoarse voice.
"Who are you?"
"I'm not sure," said Fever. The boy came panting up the hill behind him and stopped, and they stood side by side, staring at Fever.
"Lily Dismas was right,"
said the old man, more to himself than the boy.
"Whatever she is, she ain't proper human."
Something hot touched Fever's lips. She tasted redness, put up a hand to her mouth and took it away smeared with blood. Her nose was bleeding again. "Sorry," she mumbled, reaching for her handkerchief. When she looked at the old man again, he had taken out a spindly gun and he was pointing it at her.
"This ain't personal," he said. "It's my reckoning that you must be some kind of scriven half-breed. So I'm doing what's needful for the good of London and the human race."
But the cough which had been building up inside Bagman Creech's chest while he was speaking burst out of him as he pulled the spring gun's trigger. He doubled over, blue-faced, hacking. The bolt whirred past Fever's cheek like a maybug, and the sound seemed to jar something loose in her. She turned and started running.
Chapter 15. Hunting Fever.
"Master Creech!" shouted Charlie, as the girl spun about and set off into the mist.
The old man was folded over, choking. He held one hand out, waggling the gun at Charlie.
"Get her, lad!"
he managed to gasp, before another fit of coughing started. Charlie snatched the gun and hared after the girl. She was a white blob in the mist, turning a corner of the ruined house. He ran after her and saw her bounding away from him down the steep terraces of the hillside, her arms outstretched for balance. As he started down, his feet went from under him on the wet grass, and he fell and slid, but he kept hold of Bagman's gun. Halfway down the hill, Fever stopped, lost, looking for the door. Mist hung in the bushes. The door was nowhere. Maybe she had come down the wrong side of the hill.
"Help!" she shouted, but she doubted Kit could hear her. The boy was already scrambling down behind her, crashing through wet branches.
She ran on, plunging into the thick growth of scrub and alders that broke along the hill's foot like green surf. And Charlie followed her. He was Bagman's boy, and he wasn't going to lose sight of her. In among those trees, the mist was thick and the light was dim, but the girl's white coat still showed, bobbing ahead of him. He was faster than her. He got closer and saw that she was crossing a patch of green moss beyond some tall reeds up ahead. She glanced back at him, and she looked young and pretty and human. He wasn't sure he had it in him to shoot her with the spring gun, even if she was what Bagman had said she was. But he couldn't let the old man down. He looked behind him, but there was no sign of the Skinner. He plunged through the reeds. The girl was on the far side of the moss, where birches in their ragged silver wrappers stood in the mist like wands. Following her, he slithered down a short, steep stair of tree roots and plunged into cold mud. That was why the girl had taken her time crossing. She had picked her way along the top of an old drowned wall that Charlie, in his hurry, hadn't even seen. The moss he had stepped out onto was just a green rug laid over a pit brimful of watery stuff like cold black soup. It didn't suck him down like quicksand in a story. He simply sank, his mouth and nostrils filling with mud as he went under. His hands alone stayed above the surface, clutching the precious gun. He thought of Bagman, nose deep in the lagoons, hiding under his hat. And Fever, on the far bank, unsnagging her coat skirts from the brambles there and readying herself to run, stopped short, startled by his choked-off scream. Crossing the moss, she had fully hoped that the boy would miss his footing and plunge in. It had been a stratagem, and she'd been proud of it. He had a gun, but she had reason. Now, as she listened to him blurt and founder, she could think only of the chill black water forcing its way into his lungs. She turned. A hand rose from the water, holding aloft the dripping gun, which glimmered green and silver in the light that came through the leaves above. Somehow the boy got his head above the surface. She thought for a moment that he was going to point the gun at her, but he was sinking again, and he turned and threw the weapon onto the bank behind him as he went down.
"Help!"
he gasped. What harm could he do her, unarmed and half-drowned? He was a pasty little thing, younger even than her. She grabbed up a fallen branch and held it out toward him. "Take this," she shouted. Charlie went under again, drinking more mud. When he came up, the girl was still holding the branch out. He grabbed it like she'd told him. He clung to it and scrabbled along it, gasping and choking and whimpering. Struggling toward the girl, he met her eyes. They were odd colours, which scared him, but the thought of drowning scared him more. Was her helping him just a trick? Was she going to let him get almost to dry land, and then let him sink while she looked on, giggling? He felt a hot, furious anger at her for playing with him, like a cat with a mouse. But all the time he went on scrabbling his way toward her, and she didn't let go, and when he was close enough she reached out and her hot hands caught hold of his and dragged him to firmer ground. He lay there gasping. Fever backed away from him, but she didn't think he would still want to hurt her, not now that she had helped him. She said, "Why are you doing this? Why did you chase me?" Charlie's ears were still clogged with moss and mud. He looked up at the girl and he saw her mouth was moving, but all he could hear was his own heart pounding and whooshing. He thought how like a normal girl she was. Then she looked past him, scared, and he sat up so quick his ears popped, and he could hear Bagman's voice shouting out his name. Fever had forgotten the other man, the old one. She'd thought him too ill to follow her down the hill. But here he was, coming quick through the trees on the far side of the mud pool, long and black, like an idea for a new punctuation mark. She started to move, and the brambles between the birch boles snagged her coat again. And Bagman Creech was stooping to pick up the gun, then striding on across the moss like he was walking on water, his feet finding the hidden footholds under the surface without his even needing to look for them. His face was white, and his pale eyes were the colour of sunlight through fog. It was as if the sight of Fever had stripped 20 years off him and made him young and fit again. As he reached Charlie's side of the moss, he lifted the spring gun. Fever saw it and struggled harder, but it was rooty and brambly the way she was going, and she moved with nightmare slowness, her white coat catching on thorns and low branches. Bagman grinned. He pushed his jaw forward, and the set of his long yellow teeth gave him the look of one of those dogs that, once it bites you, can't let go. He strode past Charlie, and the skirts of his coat brushed Charlie's face. The girl was trapped in the trees, struggling. She let out a moaning noise, and Charlie wanted to shout out and tell Master Creech how she'd saved him from the mire, but he knew that wouldn't make any difference, 'cause she was still Scriven. She was looking at him with a white, woeful face as the Skinner moved sideways along the moss edge, seeking for a clean shot between the trees, and now something else was moving, away to the left, behind the mist. Charlie thought for a moment he must be wrong. It was just an old tree, surely, an old willow that had grown twisted, and the mist drifting past it made it look like it had moved. But then it stepped out of the mist, and it was a man, and he was holding a pocket pistol, aimed at Bagman Creech. "Stop!" shouted Kit Solent. Creech hesitated. In the silence, Kit made his way through the foliage until he was between Fever and the Skinner. Bagman's long face twitched angrily.
"Don't you go protecting her," he warned. "Them as protect Scriven is worse than the Scriven themselves."
"You don't understand a thing, old man," said Kit, his voice trembling slightly. "You don't know what she is. Put down your gun." Creech scowled, ignoring him, and Fever saw his fingers whiten as he started to squeeze the trigger of his strange old weapon. "No," shouted Kit again warningly, and then in a sort of angry grief, "No!" There was a single sharp, high-pitched clap. Kit's pistol spewed sparks and smoke. Bagman Creech seemed to jump at the sound, and for a moment there was a look of absolute amazement on his face. His gun went off, punching its dart into the undergrowth 10 feet away. He coughed quietly and fell over backward. The air was filled with tiny flakes of goose-down lining blasted out of his quilted coat. It looked like snow.
"Oh, Poskett," Kit kept saying. "I didn't mean to. I was aiming at his arm."
He had lowered his pistol. His face was nearly as white as the old man's. Charlie scrambled across the mud, shouting, "Master Creech!" Bagman's white face flopped toward him. There was pink froth in the old man's mouth, and it spilled out down his chin when he spoke.
"Go! You're the last of us. Save yourself so you can finish this."
His head dropped back. Charlie hesitated only a moment, just long enough to snatch Bagman's hat out of the mire where it had fallen. Then he was off, finding his way along the wall top easy this time, and running away between the trees.
Chapter 16. The Long Walk Home. For a while the birds, which had been scared into the sky by the gunshots, kept circling and calling.
but gradually they settled again, and it grew very quiet. Fever crouched among the birches, picturing cubes and pyramids and cones, and making herself recite their different properties. She had wrapped her arms tight round herself, and her breathing was quick and shallow, and she was trying not to move. Kit Solent dropped his pistol and stooped over the Skinner, feeling for a pulse amid the white stubble on his throat, as if there was a chance he might still be alive. Blood flowed steadily and sadly from him, looking almost purple as it curled into the green water. "I think this is Creech," he said. He tried to laugh. I think I've killed Bagman Creech."
"Who?" said Fever.
"Old Skinner General from the riots. I thought he died years ago. Well, he's dead now, all right. Oh, Poskett, I've never shot anyone before. I carry the gun in case of thieves, but I never expected... Why didn't he listen to me? The stupid old fool. I told him to drop his gun, but he didn't listen. He was just going to go ahead and... The gods alone know what he was thinking."
"What did he want with me?"
asked Fever, edging closer to look at the dead man. It seemed to her that you did not need to be an imaginary deity to understand why Creech had acted as he did. It was simply that he thought Fever's death was more important than his own life, and he had thought he would be able to kill her before Kit killed him. What she still didn't understand was what it was that had made him hate her so.
He said I wasn't human."
"He was mad," said Kit firmly. With trembling hands, he picked his pistol up and stuffed it back into his pocket. "Fever, I'm so sorry. It's my fault. I should never have brought you here. You're not ready." Fever looked up at him.
"He said I was a scriven, a half-breed scriven, but there's no such thing, is there?"
"He was a mad old man. He didn't know what you are."
"But you do."
Kit looked away, scanning the marsh for signs of movement. There were none. He left Fever alone and went to look for the Skinner's boy, but soon gave up. What could he do if he did find him? Shoot him too? The kid hadn't looked much older than Ruin. He gave up and returned to where Fever waited. "He's run off. If he goes back to London and tells what happened here, you'll be in danger. We both will. People still look up to the Skinners in the cheap boroughs." He reached down and pulled her to her feet. "Fever, can you open the vault?" The door code was as clear in Fever's mind as it had been before she met the Skinner. Her fingers knew the precise movements that they would have to make to type the right sequence on the ivory keys. But she was too scared and confused to trust Kit Solent anymore. What would happen if she did open the door for him? What would become of her when she was no more use to him?
"No," she said. "I don't know the code. I never did."
Kit stood staring at her. He was more than half sure that she was lying. When she said no, her voice dipped in the middle. When she said, "I don't know the code," a blush spread right across her face and her ears turned red. He wanted to drag her back inside the hill, force her back to the lock and make her open it. But he was not that sort of man. Ruthlessness had never been his style. All his life he'd been kind, the sort of boy who came home bloody-nosed from school after standing up for smaller boys against the bullies, the sort of man who could never bring himself to smack his children when they misbehaved, or even to stay cross with them for long. He looked at Fever as she stood in front of him all trembly and mud-stained, yet still trying to look poised and rational, and it was impossible to even imagine himself making her keep working at the lock. She needed help. She needed his protection. She needed, like any lost and frightened child, to be home. And so did he. Killing Creech had shocked him. He felt sick of Nonsuch House and its secrets. They weren't worth a life, not even the life of a crazy old man. Let the movement have them. He wanted to go home. "Come on," he said, taking Fever's hand. And she numbly let him hold it and lead her uphill to the hidden entrance. "We'll get you back to Godshawk's Head. You'll be safe there if that boy makes trouble." Kit shut the secret door behind them, and they went downstairs to where their lanterns waited. Fever's had gone out, but she found a box of matches among his tools and relit it, and stuffed the matches in her pocket as she followed him back into the tunnel. Kit did not even look at the vault door and the lock as they passed it. Fever dimly understood how much he was giving up. Half of her, the still rational half, wanted to turn back and find out if her hand still knew the dance it had longed to do on Godshawk's keypad. But she was afraid. Something deep and strange had stirred inside her when she stood there before. She had been overwhelmed by something, and the most frightening thing about it was that she could not find any rational explanation. It had felt as if she were possessed by some malevolent spirit. "I'm sorry," she managed to mumble, trailing Kit back along the tunnel. "No, Fever," he said. "I'm sorry. I should never have brought you here." They walked on in silence, and thought of the Skinner's boy herring home across the marshes somewhere above their heads. "Why did you?" asked Fever.
Bring me here, I mean. Why did you think I could help?
Kit stopped and looked at her again in the lantern light. I don't know.
But you must have had a reason for choosing me.
He turned and walked on, so fast that Fever had to run to keep up. They splashed through a flooded section of the tunnel, sloshing shadows and wet echoes ahead of them. After another 50 yards or so, Kit stopped again, turned back to her, and seemed to come to some decision.
Fever, I haven't told you the truth. Not everything.
Fever waited while he looked at the floor, the tunnel walls, the lantern, anywhere but at her, working out in his head what he had to confess to her.
It all began when I found that notebook of Godsork's at Rag Fair, he said. I didn't know what those strange designs were for, and I still don't, but it got me interested in the old man. I'd heard a lot about Godsork the King, but nothing about Godsork the Scientist. So I started asking questions, and after a while my questions led me to a girl named Katie Unthank. Her late father had been an archaeologist who'd worked sometimes with Godsork, and she had heard things from him. She had heard about the existence of the Vault, the workshop where Godsork was supposed to have devised his most secret inventions. And she had heard about you.
Me?
Katie didn't know much, only that the Order of Engineers was bringing up a child called Fever Crumb, and that you were important. There had been some kind of experiment when you were newborn. Unthank believed that some of Goldsork's knowledge had been transferred into your brain.
That's impossible, said Fever, engineerishly.
Maybe, but that's what Katie told me. Her father used to say, when that girl grows up, she'll be the key that unlocks Godsork's secrets. He claimed that whatever Godsork had done to your brain, its effects wouldn't be apparent until you were an adult. It was Katie who told me the story of the old tunnel, which was supposed to link Nonsuch with the Barbican. We spent months looking for it. We didn't find it, but while we were trying, we fell in love. After that, we were so happy and so busy with each other and the children that we let ourselves forget Godsork and his secrets. Then, last year, I heard about that cave-in and guessed the tunnel's course. I thought Katie would have wanted me to explore it and use whatever treasures I found in Godsork's vault to provide for Fern and Ruin. When I came up against his lock, I remembered that strange tale she'd told me about the child who'd gone to live with the engineers. I knew you wouldn't be old enough yet for Godsork's memories to have surfaced, but I thought that if I took you to Nonsuch House and exposed you to the old man's favourite scents and tastes, it might jog something. I shouldn't have done it. I knew all along that it was unfair to use you like that. But lately, with this news from the north, I thought it was worth trying anything that would get me into that vault before the movement arrived. I was wrong. I'm sorry.
I don't believe it's possible, said Fever again, after they had walked on a few hundred yards in silence. I don't believe Godsork could have put thoughts into my brain. That's just voodoo science, the kind of foolish story that the newspapers like to print to make people think that the ancients were capable of miracles.
But she was trying to convince herself as well as Kit, because the ancients had been capable of miracles, or at least of science so advanced that it seemed miraculous, even to an engineer. And did Kit's story not offer an explanation, at last, for the memories that had been gathering in her head like fog ever since she first went to Nonsuch House?
I'm sorry, Fever, said Kit again, after another half mile. You should not have had to hear all this from me. I don't understand it, and I can't explain it very well. You need to talk to Dr. Crumb.
Why?
He must know something. It isn't usual for the engineers to take in a baby girl. They must have known about you from the start.
No, said Fever. Dr. Crumb found me, in a basket, and he thought it would be irrational to leave me. He told me so, and he wouldn't lie. He doesn't believe in telling lies.
But as she spoke, she was touching the back of her head, tracing the silvery scar that had been there since the day she was found. Could she really believe all Dr. Crumb had told her? Was that not a little too much like blind faith? And even if she trusted him, could she trust Dr. Staling and all the other members of the Order? Katie Solent's father, who had worked for Godsork, had been the same Master Unthank whom Dr. Crumb had gone to visit on the day he found Fever. Had her discovery been carefully arranged? Perhaps Dr. Staling and the other senior engineers had taken her into the head in the same spirit that they gave space to white rats and fruit flies and cultures of bacteria on petri dishes, merely as an experiment to be observed.
Chapter 17. Storm Coming. It seemed a long, long way, that walk back through the tunnel, but they emerged at last into the antechamber behind the bookcase and stood staring at each other for a moment, like conspirators, listening to the faint sound of the children's laughter from upstairs.
That's strange, said Kit,
looking relieved that he had something else to talk about besides the contents of Fever's brain. They should be at school. The laughter grew louder as they emerged through the bookcase. They found Ruin in the hall, lumbering along on all fours, while Fern clung giggling to his back.
"Ruin's a horse!" she shouted when she saw them. "Fever, look! Ruin's a horse!"
"No, Ruin is a bipedal primate," said Fever helpfully. She had still not got the hang of make-believe. "Children," said their father, stooping to hug the little girl as she tumbled laughing off her brother's back. "Why aren't you at school?"
"School's shut," said Ruin, looking very happy about it. "Miss Wernicke's run away for fear of the nomads attacking."
"It's true, sir," announced Mistress Gloomstove, who appeared just then from the kitchen, dusting her hands on her apron. "We found a notice on Miss Wernicke's door this morning saying as how she's gone to stay with her sister in Slug's Pottage on account of the nomad horde, sir, and school's closed indefinitely. She apologised for the inconvenience, as if that made it any better. Why, I'd give her inconvenience if I had her here. Have you ever tried dusting and tidying this place, sir, with these two young savages rampaging around and getting underfoot? I'm glad to see you home to deal with them, sir, I do say."
Kit Soland gave the housekeeper his most charming smile. "I am deeply sorry, Mistress G. You know that I'd not have left them with you if I'd had the least inkling that school was off. But I'm afraid I can't relieve you of them just yet. I have to take Fever back to Godsawk's Head, you see. It will take only 10 minutes. Half an hour at most." Mistress Gloomstove's face took on a cold, far-away look.
"I don't know about that, sir. I'm employed to keep house, sir. If it's a nursemaid or a governess you're wanting..."
"Naturally, I'll make it up to you," said Kit hastily, and hurried upstairs to his office. Fern, Ruin and Mistress Gloomstove all stood and looked at Fever.
"You're all muddy," said Fern at last.
"Yes, yes I am," admitted Fever, looking down at herself. Her neat white coat was splashed and scribbled with dark sprays of brick marsh mud and greenish stains of moss and grass. For all she knew, there was blood there, too.
"I fell over," she said, rather lamely.
"In some mud."
She was glad of the clatter of Kit's boots coming back down the stairs. He had Fever's cardboard suitcase under his arm, and he was rummaging in a leather purse. "Here," he said, handing a shiny coin to Mistress Gloomstove. "I hope that'll be some small token of my thanks. Sorry it can't be more, but I must save some for the chair fare. I shall be back as soon as I can. Don't open the door to anyone while I'm gone." He kissed the children, and suddenly Fever found herself making her quick goodbyes and stepping outside after him into the sullen, stormy light, and it occurred to her that she would probably never see the house or the children again. There was rain in the air. They didn't go toward Cripplegate, but turned downhill instead, walking quickly through quiet and half-deserted streets and empty courts until they reached the edges of Limehouse, where Kit hailed a passing chair. The chief bearer asked, "Where to, mate?" And Kit told him, "Godsawk's Head." Fever climbed inside, and Kit got in with her and shut the door. As the chair set off, she heard a sound, and she thought that it was thunder, but it went on and on, coming from the lower end of the city, a shifting, snarling sound which made her think of some vast and dangerous animal stirring in its sleep. All down the street the shopkeepers were putting up their shutters, and knots of working men stood talking, turning to stare as the chair went past. The day was dark by the time Charlie Shallow got back to London. Still not noon, but the sky gone black as a winter's evening, as if the clouds themselves were putting on mourning for old Bagman Creech. He hadn't dared to go skirting back round Nonsuch Hill to find the coracle, but had run blindly through the marshes till he stumbled on a plankway, a path built by scavengers or hunters, which he followed till it brought him to the southern edge of the city. He was mud-caked and leech-nibbled, dirty water spewed from his boot-tops at every step. A wind-tram was passing, and he leapt on board, ignoring the old-fashioned looks that the other passengers gave him when they got a whiff of his marsh-steeped clothes. The tram was moving slowly, with the whole crew busy poling it along, and Charlie thought that with a bit of luck he might get several stops nearer home before anyone bothered asking him to pay. When they did, he'd have to jump off quick, because he was skint. But when the conductor finally appeared in front of him, he changed his mind. He wasn't just the potboy from the Mott and Hoople no more. He was Bagman Creech's prentice. And now Bagman was gone, that made Charlie his heir, didn't it?
"You're the last of us," Bagman had said. "The last of the Skinners."
Charlie pulled himself up stiff and straightened the old bowler hat on his head and said,
"Sorry, mate, I've got no money. I'm on Skinner's business."
"Skinner's?" said the conductor, checking his natural urge to throw this filthy, smelly urchin off his tram.
"Bagman Creech is dead," said Charlie. "We was hunting a scriven, and she had a friend, and he shot Bagman down. I've got to..."
Here he hesitated, for he wasn't quite sure what he had to do.
"I've got to sort it."
The conductor still looked uncertain, till one of Charlie's fellow passengers, a woman, said, "That boy's all right. I saw him with old Bagman up in town yesterday."
"Bagman's dead," said someone else, passing on what Charlie had said to their neighbour. The news was spreading down the tram. Even the crew were looking at Charlie now. The conductor took an oyster shell from his satchel and looped its string over Charlie's head. "Good luck, boy. Anything you need, you just ask." Charlie looked at him and at the faces of the other passengers. He wasn't used to this, to power. He wondered what Bagman would have told them. He said, "Just keep a lookout, that's all. She was in the marshes, but she could be back in town by now. She looks like a girl and she dresses like one of them engineers what live in that old head. She's got a human gent protecting her, an archaeologist name of Solent." The track swung east toward the distant terminus, and the sails flapped and then tautened, filling with a sudden breeze. The sky astern over the marshes was smeared with rain. Charlie sat down again, and no one complained now about the smell of marsh that rose from him or the stain he'd leave upon the seat slats. He'd not been sure where he was going, but he knew now. Back to Bagman's house to clean himself up and find himself a new weapon. And then he'd finish the job, find that patchskin, and kill her. Charlie hadn't reckoned on the power of rumours, though. The story he'd told had a life of its own, and it moved faster than he could. At every stop the tram made, passengers got off and told the news of Bagman Creech's death in pubs and street markets. Diggers told it to their wives, and their children overheard it and went shouting it through the shabby streets. Along Bankment Side and up Cripplegate and through all the rookeries of St. Kylie the story spread and grew. Drinkers carried it from pub to pub. In the Crate of Codlings and the Rose Revived, wild rumours got hammered into hard fact. There was a patchskin loose, maybe more than one. They were in league with the movement and hoping to seize power and have all London for their own again. Bagman Creech had found this out, and one of the skins had killed him for it. And worst of all, the murderess had human help. A ripple of anger moved through the cheap parts of town. By the time Charlie hopped off the tram at Celebrity Square, people were yelling about it in the streets and smashing the windows of any old tech shop that had ever done business with the traitor Solent. Charlie went past them, wondering what the fuss was all about. He was halfway down Straggle Market on his way to Bagman's house when a big hand grabbed him from behind and heaved him hard against a wall. He hung there, pinned, kicking at empty air and staring up once more into the large red face of Tedward Swiney.
"Christ, you stink of the bog!" exclaimed the pub keeper. "I've been looking for you all over. Is it true what they're saying? Bagman's croaked?"
Charlie couldn't answer. It was all he could do to breathe, with Ted's big fist clumping his coat collar in a tight knot against his windpipe. Ted was wearing his old oilcloth outdoor coat, which stank like a wet dog. The wind flapped it open, and in an inside pocket Charlie glimpsed the handle of the blunderbuss, which usually lived under the counter at the Mott and Hoople, in case anyone tried to rob the place or complained about the quality of Ted's beer.
"What about this patchskin girl?" Ted growled. "Still live and large, is she? Well?"
Charlie managed a nod, and Ted gave another growl and let him drop. He knelt on the cobbles, hacking and gasping.
"You sound worse than the old man did," said Ted. "Where is she, then? How do we find her? Pity to waste all this community spirit you've roused up. I ain't seen the Commons look this lively for years. So how do we get hold of her? Out in the marshes, you say?"
"Kit Solent," choked Charlie.
"And who the blog is Kit Solent?"
"He's an archaeologist. He's helping her. He murdered Bagman. Maybe he's a scriven, too. I didn't see no speckles on him, but then the girl ain't got none neither. This Solent lives up on the hill. I can't remember the street. I can take you there."
Ted Swiney cursed viciously under his breath, which helped him to think. Then he reached down and grabbed Charlie by both shoulders, lifting him to his feet. He patted the dust off him with both big hands, trying to look friendly, even fatherly, for the benefit of the gang of onlookers who had gathered to watch. He could sense the anger of the mob building. They needed a leader. But with Bagman gone, who could they turn to? Ted meant to make sure that it was him. Charlie stood there uneasily while Ted set his hat straight. Rain was falling heavily now. A chair passed, its bearers tramping along like dray horses with their heads down and the rain slicking their hair. Charlie watched it going by so that he didn't have to look at Ted Swiney's attempt at a cheery smile. He saw a girl's white face framed in the window space, the familiar curve of a shaved head.
"Ted, look! It's her!"
Chapter 18. Chair versus Chair.
The chair slowed a little as the rain came on, the bearers growing mistrustful of the greasy cobbles. Rain rattled on the roof and speckled the window glass as Fever peered out to see where they were. She saw the sign outside a tram stop, Celebrity Square. She saw more groups of men sheltering under shop awnings as the downpour increased. She saw a barrel-shaped man lurch forward out of one of the groups. He had his finger pointed straight at Fever, and he was shouting something. "Damn that bald pate of yours," said Kit Solent. "You stand out like a beacon." He thrust Fever back against her seat, out of the sight of anyone outside, but the damage had been done, and Fever could hear the roar of angry voices spreading. Her breath came in little shallow gasps, and she was afraid that she was going to be sick. Kit Solent leaned past her. He had his pistol in his hand, and he used the handle to pound on the woodwork behind her head, shouting to the lead bearer, "Faster! Faster!" The chair started to lurch as the bearers broke into a heavy trot. Fever craned her neck, looking out through the small glass pane in the back wall. She saw the barrel-shaped man flagging down a passing taxi chair. She saw his mouth move and knew that he was shouting, "Follow that chair!"
"They're coming after us," she said.
"They won't catch us." Kit Solent twisted round to look, and for a moment his head and shoulders obscured Fever's view. "Damn, that's Swiney."
"Who's he?"
"Landlord of the Mott on Ditch Street, a real troublemaker, a big man in the bad parts of town." He turned back to hammer on the wall behind Fever's head again, shouting, "Faster, man, faster! I'll make it worth your while!" A moment later the chair was racing up Cransby Notch and crossing Cripplegate. The bearers were fit and fresh and too heavily dosed with lifting drugs to question Kit's order. People who saw them coming just had to dive aside to let the chair go past. But the chair Ted Swiney had commandeered was fast, too. Fever could see it 20 feet behind, a lean red chair with go-faster stripes and three bearers, one at the front and two behind. The publican's angry face could be seen shouting from a side window. After a few hundred yards, he wriggled one hand out, too, clutching something silvery that he pointed toward Fever's chair. Fever couldn't make out what it was until his hand jerked and a flare of orange sparks and white smoke hit him. Something struck the corner of the chair above her with a startling crack.
"He's shooting at us," she said stupidly.
"Two can play at that," said Kit Solent, tugging a window open. He leaned his whole body out into the rain, and Fever heard his gun go off and saw the pale puff of smoke whipped sideways on the wind. He must have missed, though, for a moment later Ted Swiney's gun fired again, and a hole the size of a 2-quid coin appeared in the woodwork of the chair's back. Kit Solent twisted himself round and threw his empty pistol into Fever's lap, followed by the ammunition pouch and powder horn. "Reload that," he shouted, drawing out a second identical gun. He had been half expecting this sort of trouble, she realized. He had armed himself for a battle while he had been upstairs fetching her things and Mistress Gloomstove's money. She felt hopelessly, helplessly grateful to him for daring to come with her, and she hurried to do as he said, gripping the pistol with trembling fingers, terrified she'd drop it. "A charge of powder, wadding, then the ball. Ram it all home with the rod," Kit told her, shouting to make himself heard over the roar of the rain on the roof. Coarse-grained powder, black as pepper, sprinkled down her coat. Kit fired his second pistol as she pushed the ball home, and she was still busy with the ramrod when he reached back in, dropping his empty gun on her and groping for the other. The rain grew suddenly heavier. Gutters gurgled and the bearer's boots skidded as the chair turned another corner. Ted Swiney's 3-man rig was still close behind. Other chairs were joining the chase now as word got round of who it was that the publican was pursuing. One of them slammed into a fruit and veg stall at the side of the street, scattering apples and cabbages into the path of another, whose bearers stumbled and went down, the thin boardings of their chair splintering as it hit the cobbles. Crouched in Ted's chair, Charlie Shallow watched the juddering view, rain-spattered, gun-lit. He flinched each time a panicked pedestrian dived out of the chair's path, ducked whenever Solent's pistol fired from the chair ahead. Once a ball came through the boarding beside his head, making a big splintery hole that the rain gusted in through. It couldn't be worth all this, could it? He kept thinking. They were all going to end up as dead as Bagman. But there was no telling that to Ted. The publican was cursing steadily, happy and fierce in the excitement of the chase, pulling his thick body back inside the chair to reload his old blunderbuss, and then cramming himself out into the rain again to shoot, bellowing abuse at the straining bearers. "Faster, you bloggers! Faster, you useless clutes!" The gun going off again, smoke blowing through the chair with a sharp, scorched smell. "Got him! I got the blogger!" Fever finally managed to get a pistol filled before Kit asked for it, and then realized that she'd only managed it because one of Swiney's shots had hit him. He groaned as she pulled him back inside. He had dropped his pistol and there was a scorched hole in the front of his coat near the shoulder. He looked dazed and white and disbelieving. She let him sink to the floor, thinking he'd be safer there, and looked down and saw that she was still holding the loaded pistol.
The chair went pounding along a tight, brick-paved street, past pubs and eel bars and dodgy archaeopharmacies. Fever leaned out and saw that Ted Swiney's chair was still behind, though the others had missed the turning and were bunched up at the street's end, bickering about who should go first. Swiney had ducked back inside his chair to reload. What had he and Kit been thinking of, she wondered, shooting at each other? If you wanted to stop a chair, it was not at the passengers you should be shooting. She pushed herself out farther until her hips wedged in the window space. Rain battered at her face. She held on grimly to the pistol and tried to aim at the legs of Ted Swiney's forward bearer. She was about to pull the trigger when her own chair plunged suddenly into the rookeries of Kitesbridge, a tangle of grim little streets barely wide enough for it to fit through. A jutting window ledge smacked the gun from her hand, and she threw herself back inside as mossy brickwork scraped against both doors. She had a hopeless after-image of the lost pistol glinting as it bounced on the cobbles. Maybe Ted's bearers would trip on it. But when the street widened enough for her to look out again, the pursuing chairs were close behind, moving in a pack, clattering after hers through the shadow of an archway where fires burned in food sellers' braziers. Swiney popped out of his window again, gun in hand, struggling for a clear shot. Other chairs swerved to let the chase go past, crashing against one another or into the metal pillars of a wind tram viaduct which were flicking past on either side. The blare of a klaxon rebounded suddenly from the wet house fronts. Twisting round, Fever saw a huge shape slide across an intersection just ahead. A house-high mass of painted upperworks and dim-lit windows, tall smokestacks striped like gypsies' stockings. It was a land barge heading out of town along the Westerway. The barge traders must have heard the uproar and decided to quit London before the rioting spread. Fever's chair shot through the space between two of the barge's many wheels. The rattle of rain on the roof stopped for a dark, breathless moment, then began again as it shot out on the far side. Behind, one of the pursuing chairs, choosing a bad moment to try and overtake Ted Swiney's, was smashed under the barge wheels with a crunch that Fever heard even above the drumbeat of her bearer's boots. The rest stopped, bunching up behind the wreck. The barge went by, but there was another behind it, and then another, following one another like overdressed elephants. We're saved, thought Fever. But Ted Swiney's chair dove through a gap between two of the vehicles and kept coming after her. It was probably moving too fast to stop or slow down, Fever reasoned. For all its streamlining, it looked bigger than her chair, heavier, more massive. She thought, momentum equals mass times velocity. They can go as fast as us, but they can't stop or turn as quickly. It was time for some applied physics. She shouted to her bearers, turn left here, left! Because she knew where she was now. These were the streets around the head, where she had often walked with Dr. Crumb. The chair swung onto Gritpipe Lane, heading steeply downhill toward a corner where the street made a sharp right angle. Another shot from Ted Swiney's gun tore past her, rattling against a pub sign. Ahead, where the street turned, she could see a scent shop on the corner. She remembered passing it with Dr. Crumb, how he had always complained at the irrationality of it. The chair slowed as its straining bearers wrenched it round that 90-degree bend, canting steeply to one side, finials screeching along wet brickwork. A few feet behind, Ted Swiney's men tried to do the same, but their chair would not obey them. Their momentum kept driving them toward the scent shop. Charlie Shallow, feeling them lose control, kicked open a door and flung himself clear, and Bagman's bowler saved him as his head glanced off a wall. The window of the scent shop came apart in bright icefalls of glass as Ted's chair went through it sideways on. A belch of perfume from 1,000 shattered vials and bottles broke across the street. Charlie stood up carefully, checking himself to make sure that he was still all there. That bang on the head had wrenched his neck and jarred his teeth. He'd bitten down painfully on the corners of his tongue. The chair-bearers scrambled past him and scattered, bruised and bleeding, frightened of what they'd done to Ted. Charlie went to the smashed window and peered in. The wrecked chair lay on its side in the shop. Ted Swiney was scrambling out through the hole where a door had been. He saw Charlie watching and shook his fist. "I'm going to get that girl!" he growled. The curious old tech lamp inside the for-hire sign on the chair's roof exploded with a wallop of flame, singeing off both his eyebrows. Fever was two streets away by then. Her chair was slowing, juddering as her winded bearers began to weaken. She crouched on the floor and tried to help Kit Solent, shocked by the amount of blood that had soaked his clothes and the way he howled when she started to lift him. Then, without warning, the whole chair leaned sideways, and she was howling too, shrieking in helpless fright as it crashed down and slid on its side across the cobbles. "The children!" Kit was saying. "I must get back to the children!" Fever reached up and heaved the door open and clambered out. One of the bearers lay in the road, gasping for breath, his legs jerking fitfully as if he was still trying to run.
The other, too drugged to notice what had happened, stood patiently between his splintered shafts. Fever reached down into the chair and did her best to help Kit Solent out. "I'm sorry," she kept saying uselessly as he cried out at the pain.